I'm going on the second half to quickly mention a few items of Air Florida that were in the news this week so we can follow them every week. Go then jump to Fritz Kramer, the mentor of Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger, and then if I have time, go back to Air Florida or do it next week because I have so much material on both subjects and there's only 30 minutes left. One article in the New York Times this week, important article along the lines that I was leading to in the four parts that I did before. The title of the article is Air Florida Crash Cockpit Conversation Fails to Answer the Key Questions on the Takeoff. Remember they said if we only have the recorder, we'll have all the questions answered. This article says that the cockpit conversation does not answer the questions. The tapes do not resolve the vital puzzle of why the two pilots couldn't keep aloft. They had doubts of the pilots about the weather. They talked about that. 10 seconds after the plane began rolling, the pilots had a near monologue of concern. They were evidently puzzled by the instrument readings. One said, it is, there's 80. The other said, no, I don't think that's right. The other said, maybe it is, I don't know. And moments later, 74 were dead and in the river. The question asked in this article is why all the uncertainty of what was going on? Why did the crew fail to cut the power and abort the takeoff, particularly in the early stages? Now, that's what I asked on the KLRB immediately after the accident. For the first 2 weeks, I had a pause for 2 seconds and said that's when there was trouble with the instruments and they knew that they were going to have a problem. The article said this question of why did they fail to abort the takeoff, particularly in the early stages, leads to a host of other questions. They've had training in the snowstorm. Did the manufacturer warn them on takeoffs in such weather? Were the Boeing bulletins worded enough? What should they do? But it goes on to say opinions differ about the pilot's failure to abort the takeoff when the instruments evidently gave abnormal readings why they continued. Many officials and experts, including Boeing officials, think there is plenty of opportunity to have aborted this flight, and they don't understand why they didn't do it. The crew was aware that another plane was coming in for landing behind them. This article doesn't say that they were ordered to take off. It did develop enough speed, although it was a little bit slower than normal, but why couldn't it be kept aloft? And that's a question they asked. In 18 or more cases where abnormal maneuvers occurred in similar circumstances, none of the planes crashed. What doomed this crash? And then it concludes, the article may never be known. Charles Miller, former official of the National Transportation Safety Board, said, we have a classic case here, a case people will be studying for years. Doesn't that sound like the Lincoln assassination or the Kennedy assassination? A classical case to study for years. Another article from the Washington Post, it's too easy to blame the pilots. And this is an interesting story because it said, don't duck again the real question in the Air Florida crash. It's written by Douglas Fever. And it said, some will argue with benefit of hindsight that the crew should not have taken off in the first place. But can one assume that Captain Larry Wheaton and Captain Co-pilot Roger Pettit did not set out to commit suicide? If you accept that proposition, then the question of why they took off, considering the weather, has to be addressed. Now, again, that goes back to what I was saying about Candy Jones or the pilot Roger Pettit coming from the Air Force. If they were instructed to behave in this way, just as Candy was told to commit suicide, and they had to go off, that would be an explanation. They are trying to assume that they didn't want to commit suicide, but you have to keep in mind the fact, what if they were programmed to do just what happened? Along those lines, another airplane crash took place. One was January the 13th, February the 9th. Airliner plunges into Tokyo Bay. 21 are dead. And then it turned out that the pilot in that plane crash underwent psychiatric tests. He said he felt sick. He pushed the control stick forward, and this was a question of a mind problem. The first stories about this plane crash said that the pilot, Seiji Katagiri, first report said he was dead. The next reports said he was alive, that he was suffering from lapses of memory. He couldn't speak. All he did was feel nausea, and he had been under the care of a psychiatrist up to that time. Now, that raises a question, such as the CIA testing drugs specifically for people to commit suicide or kamikaze flights to hide sabotage. Were these pilots being tested, just as the Japanese pilot was sick and under psychiatric care, were they being tested in some way for this particular operation? And finally, we'll put off, I think, till next week, the parts on Air Florida and the links to Western Airlines competition for holding on to Western, this Neil Burke that I mentioned, who came into the picture, wanted to keep control and money into Western Airlines to keep from Air Florida taking. And I mentioned last week the attorney for Kirk Kerkorian, Frank Rothman, and his links to Howard Hughes and Greg Boutzer organization and Fred Benninger, who was appointed on the board of Western Airlines 2 days before Air Florida went down. I just might tell you to whet your appetite that this Fred Benninger, who was appointed by Neil Burke to be on the board of Western Airlines 2 days before when they're competing with Air Florida to control Western Airlines, this Fred Benninger that I mentioned last week worked with the Flying Tigers for 21 years. The Flying Tigers and Air America were part and parcel of the same fabric, and this is a convoluted web, and I don't want to rush through it. I'll get back to it next week, to the role of the Flying Tigers, Fred Benninger, Kirk Kerkorian, and the assassination teams centering around Modalitz, Las Vegas, Robert Mayhew, the Howard Hughes Organization, Permandex. There's a whole group in Hollywood that have direct links to the past assassinations, and they have a lot of power in Hollywood today, and I want to identify them, and they are not separate from the conflict with Air Florida and the competition with Air Florida at this time. But I think I don't want to rush through that, so I think I'll do that in detail next week with you, because I want to continue part three on the story of Fritz Kramer. I referred to an article sent to me from back east from the New York Times, March the 2nd, 1975, or the Washington Post, The Iron Mentor, Fritz Kramer, the godfather of Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. He is a very important person. He influenced these men and the positions they have and their policies. And he works in the State Department. He worked with the National Security Council and the State Department. And I want to go over some material that a woman sent me, a long listener, subscribes to the tapes, a fantastic researcher. I don't think she wants me to mention her name on the air. I'm really a genius at pulling out information. And she's the one who had sent me the original article on Fritz Kramer, the Iron Mentor, and quotations from various books. And I want to run down 8 questions with you, or 8 facts, and then ask you a question about Fritz Kramer and go into some of the documentation. It is a fact that during World War II, from 1943 to 1945, till the war was over in the spring of 45, that our OSS agents from the American government, headed by Alan Dulles and Wild Bill Donovan, were meeting with members of the Nazi Party, Hitler's stormtroopers, the SS, and making arrangements for when the war was over to get back together again. It is true that the Vatican was writing passports for the top Nazis to go through Southeast Asia and through the Middle East into South America, and that the representatives from the Vatican worked with I.G. Farben. And again, this current pope worked for Farben at Auschwitz and went to Rome and was part of the operation of spreading these Nazis around. It is a fact that the Battle of the Bulge was stalled at the end of the war in December 1944 for the purpose of Germans taking all their money and art and gold out of Germany and out of the banks before the Allies got there. And that operation was called Operation Bernhardt, the counterfeiting of money and pouring it into Swiss banks. A lot of them kept in the bank of Evita Peron. And the year she died, it was unleashed for Otto Skorzeny and Hallmar Schacht and the top Nazis to run with it. It is a fact that the Nazi intelligence from the East, Reinhard Gehlen, was taken to the United States to the Pentagon to head and form our Central Intelligence Agency so that by 1947 it was all set for going from 45 to 47 and the National Security Council. It is a fact that Dr. Rudolf August Wineker from Germany was brought in by Earl Warren and the Warren Commission to write the Warren Report for the Pentagon to conceal the Nazis and the military behind the murder of John Kennedy. It is a fact that Otto Skorzeny, a top Nazi, was allowed to leave a prison in Europe and begin organizing in South America, Spain, Middle East, Ireland, headquarters for the Nazis after World War II. It is a fact that Hallmar Schacht, the head of the Nazi Reichsbank, worked with John J. McCloy, who was a member of the Warren Commission when John Kennedy was killed, who was head of Chase Manhattan Bank, with the Rockefellers, and worked with Alan Dulles. Schacht and Skorzeny were working together as soon as they were released and were working with Aristotle, Onassis, and Nazis over the world. Now, getting back to Fritz Kramer, I have references here from about five books about the Battle of the Bulge that this particular friend sent to me. She sent me, photocopied the pages of the books, and then I procured the books. And the Battle of the Bulge was going on in 1944, December of 44, and I have two books. There are many books on this subject, but I have two very important books. One is called Betrayal at Arnhem by A. Lorenz. This came out in 1969 and is published by Charter of New York. And this book goes into the fact that the American Army was betrayed at the Battle of the Bulge, and they were betrayed by a top Nazi who did infamous treachery where many people were murdered. 7,000 of the 10,000-man invasion were killed or taken prisoner. And it is the belief of the author of this book, Betrayal at Arnhem, that the person who betrayed them was Prince Bernhard. He went on to marry Queen Juliana. He was a representative of IG Farben, a Nazi, and he betrayed. They thought he was working with the alternative army, trying to overthrow the Nazis, and he was betraying the American army to stall that battle. And this book is called Betrayal at Arnhem. There's another book, The Battle of the Bulge, Dark December, by Robert Merriam, published in 1947 by Ballantine Books, on the betrayal at the Battle of the Bulge. Now, a book that was referred, this person back east told me about, is called Hitler's Bodyguard. This is one of the books that she sent to me about a group in Germany. It's written by Alan Weikes, W-I-K-E-S. There was a group called the Liebstandart, Liebstandarte. This was Hitler's bodyguard, the SS, and this book by Alan Weikes claims that a group of people swore as early as 1933 or so that they would live all their lives and be loyal to Hitler. They swore a personal oath to Hitler. And these people were involved in the Battle of Malmedy. This was a very important battle in December 1944 in the Battle of the Bulge. And this book, and another book that I have the title for you, has pictures of four Nazis at a trial in 1945 that were responsible for having American soldiers gunned down. The orders came, kill everyone in sight, and 86 of the prisoners were killed. 100 Americans were taken in one particular battle. Some pretended they were dead. And the people in charge of this killing of Americans involved Sepp Dietrich, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. That's number 11 in the pictures in the book. Number 33 is Fritz Kramer. And number 45 is Hermann Preiss. And number 42 is Joachim Pieper, P-E-I-P-E-R, was involved in killing Americans at the battle at Malmedy and later was instrumental in Joe McCarthy's career, working with Joe McCarthy and other Nazis while he was working in Congress in the United States. Now the question arises, is this Fritz Kramer, the same Fritz Kramer that discovered, in quotes, Henry Kissinger down in Louisiana and took Kissinger to the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944, Kissinger stayed in Europe 1 year after the war. The war was over in April of 45. Kramer got him a job for $10,000, staying in Germany for 1 year, then got him a scholarship at Harvard and a mentor, a violently anti-communist mentor that I'll go into later. And this party asked me in the memo, she said, is this Fritz Kramer responsible for killing the Americans? And then is this the same man who comes back to the Pentagon and becomes the head of the Pentagon chief of staff where he is today? Can a Nazi who killed Americans in the Battle of the Bulge, who was tried at Dachau for war crimes and was released the next year, could he then be taken to the Pentagon? Well, the answer to that question goes back again to a known set of facts that I listed for you. If Hitler's top chief of intelligence formed the CIA, and if Mr. Otto Winokur, a Nazi, is the chief historian for the Pentagon, and I've mentioned on other programs, the head of Douglas MacArthur's intelligence chief was a German who used an alias, Charles Willoughby, who is actually a pro-Franco-German. Is our Pentagon run by Nazi war criminals? If we brought Galen here, if Prince Bernhard marries Queen Juliana, who's part of IG Farben, and starts the Bilderbergers, where the heads of corporations meet every year, if Hallmar Schacht and Otto Skorzeny worked with the CIA and trained all over the world as soon as they were released, then what would be so obnoxious of the same Fritz Kramer who put Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger into office being in the Battle of the Bulge and betraying the Americans at the Malmedy Massacre? Are 100 Americans or 86 Americans any different than Charles Horman? Think about it. I doubt it. And this is what Gerald Ford said. That was his quotation. It's the larger factors that you have to consider, not the individual person. There's a book out. The same friend sent me a copies of this book. It's called Skorzeny by Charles Whiting, published in 1972, and it shows him at the war crime trials. And it has a picture of Otto Skorzeny with a Forrest Yeo Thomas, the White Rabbit. And what they did at the Battle of Malmedy, when the Americans were betrayed and led and killed, they wore American uniforms and acted and infiltrated the American troops by dressing as Americans. And this book has a picture of Fritz Kramer in this role, and Skorzeny admitting at a trial that he distributed the ammunition to his men before the Battle of the Bulge. And Skorzeny, who bragged about that, was with United States Pentagon and military officials and with the Central Intelligence Agency. If we worked with all these people, couldn't that be the same Fritz Kramer? He's never been photographed except in the Nazi days. Is that the Fritz Kramer? Now, they wore American uniforms. Fritz Kramer went around. He was a lawyer from Italy. He was at a two PhDs. He got one in Germany, one in Italy. He lived in Italy when Mussolini was there. He's the fellow I told you whose wife went to live with his mother during World War II. And they lived there through the entire Nazi regime. His son Sven Kramer then went on to Harvard to become a student of Henry Kissinger. He came to the United States. His brother was interred in Great Britain as a Nazi during World War II, and he came directly to the United States Army in 1943, procured Henry Kissinger. Could he have gotten the Army uniforms with Henry Kissinger? I'm asking these questions because you can't outright say it, but where would Mr. Kramer, Fritz Kramer, and Henry Kissinger, who in December 44 are in the Battle of the Bulge, the exact place where the massacre took place, and later the people involved in the massacre are going to work for Senator Joe McCarthy's campaign. Is this how they got the American uniforms? Now, I've never asked a question more serious. I've been on the air 11 years, but I've never asked a question more serious than, is this the same Fritz Kramer? He has never been photographed. That just once in one magazine section of an article I talked about. He wears a monocle. He takes a small, in quote, salary. He's not seen. Is this the Fritz Kramer? Could they have supplied the uniforms for the American soldiers to die? This is an important question, and it should be answered, I believe, by members of Congress and private individuals forcing an answer. Another section of a book that this party sent to me has a map of Malmedy and the Ardennes, and it is a description of the Malmedy massacre of the American soldiers in December 1944, and then the book of Kissinger and Fritz Kramer, they were at that location in 1944. They were in that exact location. Kissinger and His Rise by David Hanna has them at the exact spot. And don't forget, this is the spot where Prince Bernhard from IG Farben is to be working in betraying the same troops in the same battle situation and go on to become a world leader and a spy for the Lockheed, for the Nazis, for the parties over in Europe who have thrown Europe on the brink of World War III. At the time, their stated goal, but now there's a few young people there that aren't so anxious to die. The book Henry Kissinger by Ralph Blumenfeld, I mentioned it last week, Signet book 1974, described Henry Kissinger with Mr. Kramer with the 84th Army when it moved into Germany. Henry was made a German-speaking interpreter for the commanding general in the closing months of the war, March 1945, at age 24. In December 1974, he was in a frozen foxhill near Bogtown in Belgium beside Private Anton Mudari of Syrian descent, who's now a Boston rug merchant. And it tells about his career of going from 1943 from Louisiana with Fritz Kramer and being taken right to Belgium in this time period. And then after the Battle of the Bulge, Henry is somewhere else, and Kramer is staying over in Europe. Now, from the books I have on Fritz Kramer, there are some missing years until 1947, till he comes back to Washington, D.C. But was he tried at Dachau? Is this the Fritz Kramer that was tried with these other people for the Malmedy offensive? They were out within a year. Was he that Fritz Kramer that's sitting in that chair that's photographed here, who was the mentor of Kissinger and Haig? Another book on Henry Kissinger. I have several books, quite a few on him, and I got turned on to them by this friend back east who put all this information together. Tells about Kissinger in Army Intelligence and his work in Belgium and so forth. The book says he did not go into battle with G Company. He was no longer a rifleman. You bet you believe he didn't go into it. November the 8th, the evening before his combat unit penetrated the German border, Kissinger was unexpectedly pulled out and reassigned to the G2 Division Intelligence as a driver interpreter for General Bolling. It was his first direct benefit from his friendship with Fritz Kramer, who by then was a G2 sergeant in the 84th Army. Kramer goes, family is in Nazi Germany, we're fighting the Nazis. He comes to the United States, gets into the Army, has his Army uniform, recruits Kissinger, and those two dogs are floating around in their tanks in the time when all this action is taking place, and our Army is being killed, and they've been singled out. Nobody is to be taken a prisoner. They're all to be murdered. And they're fighting the Germans, and here is Kissinger with Kramer in counterintelligence, and then they stay on and occupy Germany and meet some of their old buddies and come back and work with only Nazis in America when they get home. Henry Kissinger was instrumental in the murder of Allende, and as soon as Allende was killed, Pinochet had swastikas and flags in Chile, and he was instrumental in other countries to put Nazi regimes into power. Another book, Senator Joe McCarthy, Meridian Books, 1959. It describes the link of the people involved in the Malmedy massacre and the Nazis behind Joe McCarthy and the troops that were run by Colonel Joachim Peiper and his relationship to McCarthy and the people that put him into power with his red baiting. Joe McCarthy was put in by very conservative pro-Nazi backers in Wisconsin by the German-American community. This is a book on the life of Senator Joe McCarthy, World Book, Meriden Brooks, published it. It says that Frank Susenbrenner and Walter Harnischfeger were two people that worked hard for McCarthy. Sessenbrunner was a president of Kimberly-Clark Paper Company, that's Kleenex, and so forth. He was a president of the board of University of Wisconsin. Harnischfeger was president of Harnischfeger Company of Milwaukee. They made traveling cranes, overhead machinery, prefabricated houses. They encouraged his ultra-rightism, his admiration for Hitler, and so forth. And the University of Wisconsin, they had an autographed copy of Mein Kampf that was displayed. During the war, Harnischfeger advocated a negotiated peace with Germany, and as soon as the war ended, they played a leading role in organizing the German Relief Society. The Harnischfeger Corporation was one of eight Midwestern concerns that held war contracts that were ordered by the President's Fair Employment Practices Commission. After 1945, Harnischfeger made several trips to Germany. He criticized dismantling German war factories, denounced the war crime trials, and urged the restoration of Germany's colonies. And these are the people behind Joe McCarthy. And these people were in Germany when Henry Kissinger was there, when Fritz Kramer was there, and they were getting ready to bring Mr. Kramer home. When did he come home, and was he part of the entire fabric of the Nazi plans to have a person in the United States who could supply uniforms for Nazis to kill Americans? That is what they did, Mr. Skorzeny and their gang. Another book, Henry Kissinger by David Landau, that I mentioned before, talks about the role of Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger in this area. I think this Battle of the Bulge is terribly important. What happened in Europe is important in terms of killing Americans. The role of Prince Bernhard as a betrayer, if this book is true, if the information is true, how they betrayed the American troops and decimated them to stall the war and to get rid of as many Americans as they could at that scene and to give themselves a prominence. Out of that Battle of the Bulge comes Prince Bernhard, who at that time wasn't married to Queen Juliana. He was, as I say, with Nazi IG Farben. He played two sides of the coin as a counterintelligence agent. This has been described in one book, and I emphasize again, where did the American uniforms come from and who are these people? Now, I think the only way to understand the activity of the killing of one American, a young American, Charles Horn, or the lies in Chile, or what is going on in El Salvador, or Guatemala, or Nicaragua, or in Poland, the only way to understand it is to identify those people who have been running our government since the end of World War II. They have betrayed the Constitution. They have turned us over to the German and Japanese and South Americans as this country gets bankrupt. You can detail maybe 40 reasons for the selling of America, wasting our money in Vietnam and South Korea, spreading our troops all over the world. We have reduced our chances of gaining full employment in this country, full education, full housing, recreation. None of the things that we should be having are we having because they have instilled with us the necessity for constantly making war and making weapons. And every one of these people pushing it have these German names. They have links to World War II. They have links to Adolf Hitler and Himmler and Otto Skorzeny, Hallmar Schacht, and the list goes on and on. The answer to tomorrow's problems is back then in the past. And if you can't face the past, be ready to live with the future. There are answers to the problems today. They're not simple, but they're there. And the right question should be asked of our public servants in Washington now to make them see what is going on. The problem, again, goes back to dinner with Andre. It's that some of us can't move, some are paralyzed and treading water, and those who ask the questions have trouble relating it to other people around. They can't find the people to share it with. Break that and you have your way home to a free and safe world. That is the problem, and I don't know if it can be answered. In the meantime, you keep doing your homework, and we'll do some more interesting stories that are breaking in the news. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Bressel. This program originates from Carmel, California.